What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Hastings Harvest, where I interview the most inspiring young minds, creators, and educators within their areas of expertise and try to harvest how they go about their craft. Today's episode is with R.C. Walden. He is a writer and YouTuber with over 195,000 subscribers. In his videos, he shares insights on storytelling, creativity, reading, and writing. I actually stumbled upon his videos one day through YouTube Recommended, and I thought, you know what, let me reach out to him on Instagram and see if he'll join me in a podcast episode, and he agreed. So in this episode, we go over his beef with waking up at 5 a.m. and his beef with just hyper-productivity in general, and how that's actually detrimental to your creativity, the disconnect between YouTubers and their audience, journaling tactics to improve your storytelling, and why getting your heart broken is one of the best things that you can actually do. If you want to find RC, you can find him on YouTube at RC Walden if you just search him up, or on Instagram, which is r.c.walden. With all of that out of the way, I must apologize because during this podcast episode, my microphone was pretty messed up. I tried to edit it as best as I could, but hopefully it's not too bad for you. I promise that will be fixed next podcast episode. And yeah, that is it. So let's get into the episode. Robin is your actual name, which I didn't even know before you entered this room, because I've only seen RC on the internet. What does that stand for, by the way?
So RC is my middle name, which I think no one's ever going to know. It's kind of like MKBHD. Like no one ever knows what the K is, you know? So I think I'm going to play a similar trick and, you know, keep the C a secret so people can, you know, form their conspiracy theories around this name of mine. But yeah, Robin's my first name, and yeah, Walden's the last name, and here's just RC Walden. Like, that's what I go by on the internet.
Sweet. Well, it is amazing to have you on the podcast. I'm excited to get into the topics I have planned and see what we get into that isn't planned. And I want to start this off because I was doing a little bit of research into you. You know, I've seen quite a few of your videos, and that definitely provides a door with which to look at your personality and your life. But I was on Google looking you up, admittedly, and I saw you had some articles on Medium, I think it's called.
Yeah, Medium.
Right? Yeah, and there was one particularly that stood out to me, which was about why you hate waking up early, how and why I avoid early mornings.
Yep.
So what's your beef with that? And do you think that is such an overhyped thing right now to be waking up early? Like, what, I guess explain a little bit about what you wrote in that and your thought process behind that.
See, I think there are two different temperaments of people. Of course, my friend Matt Collins, who I just did a video with on my YouTube channel and language learning, he is sort of like the stereotypical Puritan, sort of waking up at 5 a.m. every morning, and I need to get my juicing in every morning. I need to get my health in check, like, you know, to the letter. But then there's also the artistic sort of temperament. The artistic temperament sort of is like, I think people's brains are just kind of wired differently. And for me personally, you know, routines is something that I struggle with quite a bit. And I sort of prefer to let my sentiments take me wherever I go and sort of rely on a base level, like a very, very basic kind of routine. But on top of that, I just let my, you know, let feelings or emotions, let whatever move me. And so that entire process, I think we have to recognize that there are different groups of people. You know, people that are bound by routines shouldn't feel bad if they can't access the artistic temperament. People who have the artistic temperament, well, shouldn't necessarily feel bad about not waking up on time, because a lot of, well, artists and musicians and poets and whatnot, especially some of the friends in my poetry reading circle, or like people who, you know, are in this line of work, you know, frequently we're very much night owls. And sometimes we know that, like, you know, it's biologically, it might not be the best thing for you. But over time, as you click into that work routine, especially when you're young, especially when you got some extra energy to burn off, well, this is going to be, well, the last of your productive years as a creative, as an artist. So since we still have this energy right now, since we still have this capacity to work late into the night, and work, you know, according to our sentiments, according to like this artistic temperament. So I think it's not necessary for us to, should I say, fit ourselves into some golden standard. What that's going to create, that's going to create guilt. And guilt is probably, I think it's the least effective motivation, you know, that you can access. So I think the reason why I wrote the article wasn't, you know, to discourage people from waking up for 5 a.m. It's simply a sort of like this contrarian sort of being sort of like devil's advocate and be like, you shouldn't wake up at 5 a.m. because blah, blah, blah. But whereas in reality, it's just an invitation for people to really experiment what floats their boat instead of buying to some grand narrative of like, this is it, this is the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have been trying to communicate that within a lot of my videos, how there's no one way to go about being successful with doing whatever it is that you want to do. And that thinking you have to meet the certain archetype can cause a lot of guilt within you, a lot of unnecessary guilt. And it may not be the optimal lifestyle for you anyway. I just see that a lot on especially channels within my niche of self-improvement. Like, you got to wake up this time, do this type of morning routine, you know, all these different self-help practices. And I really like to tell people to challenge those things and see, really, do those things work for your life? Because, and I've said this in a video before, I used to, when I first started off in like self-improvement, like really getting into that type of stuff, I was doing a whole lot of those like typical habits, and it's been reduced down now to like 20% of them. So it's like the 80-20 rule, you know, 20% of those habits that I was doing was producing 80% of the results. So I just stuck with those. So I'm very glad you brought that up. And it seems like most people's creativity, from what I've heard, and certainly with myself, not only does it come out spontaneously, and that's kind of just the nature of creativity, but it also appears more so during the nighttime. Like, that seems to be a common thing. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, you don't have people yelling at you around the clock. You don't have annoying people in the streets, you know, trying to trip you over, you know? I think it's just sensory. It's kind of like, it's the closest thing that you're ever going to get to sensory deprivation. And it's the closest, well, distance that you're going to get, you know, with yourself, with your creative voice, so to speak. And yeah, sometimes I feel like ideas just sort of hit me late at night, and because it's so quiet, because I don't have, the TV's not on, or like I'm not on my phone. And then sort of spontaneously, things just start to click, and they start to click, and you think to yourself, ah, damn it, I have to get this done now. And you look up, it's already 2 a.m. in the morning. You're like, I have to go to university tomorrow. So it's a constant cycle. And I don't think it's necessarily at night, but it's just, creatives need a lot of time to be bored. This is why I adore the concept of creative procrastination, because our culture right now is at war with procrastination, because like productivity is such on the top of the chain, and productivity is like the 1-0 and the end all be all. If you can't be productive, you're kind of like a lazy slob or whatever. But some of the greatest idea that I've received ever was, you know, I can basically safely attribute all of these ideas to my absolute inability to get into the shower. So before I head into the shower, I do this. Oh, it takes 2 hours for me to, you know, to build up the courage of heading to the shower. It's not like a psychological, or it's not like a psychological illness or a mental disorder, but it's just the shower to me is such a big thing that I just want to avoid it as long as possible. And so that little procrastination that I do before I hop into the shower, I typically find myself, you know, roaming around the room and then mumbling to myself and writing things down here and there. So anything that is in the shower, I would do. And in that process of free associating and mumbling to myself and sort of like reading bits and pieces from different books around the house, that sparks some pretty interesting ideas. And by the time I'm in the shower, a really solid video idea or article idea or like a piece of writing idea or photography idea or, you know, some ideas for sketches, they're already fully formed in my head. So by the time I get out of the shower, it's ready to go.
So it's kind of like you have an unintentional dedicated time to produce creative ideas. And all that stems from boredom, which I've actually wrote about in the self-help book that I released a couple of years ago, which now when I look back on it, you know, it's okay. I wrote it in like, it was something I wrote in a summer. And I think there's some great ideas in there, but you know, when I look back, I was a completely different person back then. And I'm criticizing it too much. It's an okay book for beginner self-help people, but you know, I talk about the idea of becoming as bored as possible, which I think is just incredibly rare now.
It's so rare. Yeah.
The phone is the biggest distraction to boredom. It gets in the way of boredom, and it still does to this day for me. And it's just highlighting how important just complete nothingness is to producing something. Like, there needs to be that buffer period of just complete nothing that you're describing, so that your brain just spits out ideas. And I was actually listening to the Tim Ferriss podcast recently. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Big fan.
Giant fan. Love him. Yeah. And he had, I think the guy's name was Neil Gaiman. You probably know him.
Neil Gaiman's amazing.
Yeah. And he talked about, you know, making sure he's in an environment, specifically with creative work, where it's either he has to write or he can't do anything. Like, there's no in between. So basically, after a while, your brain, when you're doing nothing for so long, is going to be like, well, I'm going to produce something. There's nothing else I can do. And your brain kind of gets activated to do the work that you need to do. And the phone really is the biggest barrier, and still is to this day. It's crazy. Have you used any sort of techniques to overcome that, or like your phone less? How do you
creative block about that? The creative block sort of thing,
or just like
or
just like how to? I mean, there's not many real solutions other than just like put your phone in another room, or like get apps that like an app that helps you lock yourself out of other apps. Like, how else can you, if you have any other solutions to just not use your phone as much?
Well, I really think that I'm like a 40-year-old in a 21-year-old's body, because like social media overwhelms the crap out of me. Like, you know, my friends told me recently to get TikTok, and I'm like, you guys spend 4 hours on this thing, right? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, let me see what all the hype is about. So I open up the app, and I just remembered myself like getting a semi panic attack because there's so much information coming my way. So I think I have, my native level of information tolerance is so low that even Twitter sometimes freaks me out. Even Facebook freaks me the hell out. No, Instagram is probably the cleanest medium that I'm like happy to like put stuff on there and then listen to stuff. But yeah, I just do not like looking at my phone just natively. Just like kind of like, it's just not what I turn to get stimulation. You know, a book is so much better, or like, because right now I moved from the city to a suburban house near the beach. So every time when I go to university, I have to take a long train ride that's about like an hour long. So that hour-long train ride is just, you know, it's the most meditative little box that I could ever go into. You know, it's just an hour of pure meditation. And I do meditate every single day, you know, as a practice, but unintentional meditation for me typically happens on a train. And that's where I allow my brain to like free associate. That's when I allow my brain to basically like zone out. And you know, later today after this podcast, I'm going to the art gallery to look at, there's a Chanel show, Gabriel Chanel show of dresses. You know, art gallery for me is also another unintentional sort of like meditative chamber. So circling back to your question, how do I deal with this information overload thing? Well, I don't, because I don't know how to deal with it. It's just technology for me is it's like a tool. And I never, ever, ever feel the need to like check things or, you know, staying up to date with the Kardashians or like, you know, like I just feel like my information tolerance is so low that sometimes even just the most simple form of social media could overwhelm me. And that sort of baseline level of, you know, absolute, you know, informational intolerance gave me this ability, in a sense, to be, you know, more creative in the 21st century. You know, partly I'm grateful for, another part I'm just kind of like, but sometimes I can't relate to what people are talking about. Sometimes I can't watch a film because it's so overwhelming. But in terms of creativity, excuse me, but in terms of creativity, I think it's absolutely fantastic to have those hours of train rides or to have those hours of at the art gallery, just absolutely zoning out because you're creating that space for you to experience ideas, but you're also experiencing or creating that buffer for you to truly appreciate art because it's rare nowadays to look at a painting for 10 minutes, hell, even 5 minutes. It's rare nowadays for you to like appreciate a jazz piece. You know, last week, my sister and I went to a jazz club, and that was the first time that I listened in so closely that, you know, one of the pieces moved me absolutely to tears. And like, that's not really an experience that you can get if you're distracted all the time. If you're too busy recording the show and not appreciating it, if your instinct is to pull out your phone at an art gallery or at a jazz show, then you know you're not creating that safe space for yourself. So yeah, I really value that safe space, and I'm just not that good with information. I'm just not that good with tech. So that's how I deal with it.
Oh man, I once you said the part about recording and not actually experiencing the thing, it gives me flashbacks to, so back in Buffalo, I would do a lot of like promo videos, recap videos of these concerts, these hip hop concerts I would go to for my friends who have a hip hop group who are some of my closest friends. And I love producing stuff like that for them. And that was really it for me. It was, I would be recording the whole show and then I'd get home and I'd be like, oh man, I didn't even get to be at the show because I was too busy recording.
Exactly.
And I guess that's possibly a metaphor for just life in general for people who are too busy and have that incredible pressure that I also feel to just always be doing and improving and being better. And it's, well, just,
it's worse if you're a YouTuber, because like sometimes when I head out there, I'm like, I watch all of these like study YouTubers and, well, literature YouTubers, you know, what do? They're like, oh, come book hunting with me, or come to the art gallery with me, or do this with me. And they shoot a little vlog. But like the problem that I have with that is like, you know, for me, because I've, you know, I get sensory overload really quickly. So for me, because there's this kind of like, I feel things very deeply, you know, from certain paintings and or certain art forms. And sometimes it becomes such an overwhelming experience that I'm just kind of like, I am physically incapable of getting a camera out right now and to pretend that I'm like standing in front of this thing and here I am on YouTube, you know. So my video sort of gradually took on the form of me explaining my experience instead of actually filming me in the scenery, because I feel like anytime there's a camera in the room, anytime there's sort of like this, Hunter S. Thompson talked about this, you know, the technology warps reality, you know, a camera warps reality, you know, whatever you capture in the camera, that's already, you know, that's, you're already removing the subject away from their organic reality, because whenever people see the camera, people act differently. So I think, yeah, being a YouTuber is such a tough, especially in my niche, in my field, you know, sometimes maybe in yours too. It's so hard to capture exactly what your day is like, you know, well, at the back of your mind, you know that your reality has already been, you know, interfered with by this piece of technology. So how do we achieve that balance point, which is like documentation, but also being honest? You know, that's the code that I'm trying to crack. Like, how do we not feel weird about having a camera following us all the time? Because it is a constructed reality. You know, YouTube or personalities online, it's completely constructed. So how do we bridge that gap? How do we be completely honest whilst realizing that nothing's ever going to be real?
Right. I think it's important to realize that. And I want people to know that, despite like I'm super vulnerable on my channel and like authentic, like as authentic as I can be. But at the end of the day, you know, my YouTube personality is a YouTube personality. Like I would say I'm pretty different in person. Not that much different, but like when a camera's on, you know, I'm definitely much more, I don't know how, what to say here, like emotional, colorful on camera, like, you know, uptight, like peppy and like, hey, I'm presenting to a camera. I want to be interesting.
You know, I'm the other way around. Yeah, in real life, I'm an absolute idiot. But like on camera, it's just kind of like I'm very kind of like, you know, logical. And then, yeah.
But yeah, no, I think it's important for the viewer to understand that, is that like, you know, when I tell the stories that I do know, because I'm really trying to become a better storyteller like yourself, because I just love to do it. I like you dramatize things within your daily life that happen. I mean, that's just the reality of entertainment, any form of entertainment, even reading books, you know, even reading your articles online. Like there's a sense of dramatization with it that I don't know. I mean, I feel like people understand it with like books, but maybe not with like social media sometimes, or I could just be completely wrong. But as a creator myself, like I just, now I really see it because I've been doing it for so long and I'm like, okay, yeah, this is like not really anything like how this person's life is. But it's a tough thing to navigate, because you got to think about how you're influencing people, and like, are people coming, like something I got to ask myself, and I think it's true that people are coming out of my videos feeling better about themselves rather than worse about themselves. And I think a lot of influencers, I hate that word, need to ask themselves that. And like, you're literally an influencer, like that's in the name, you're influencing people in some way. And so are your videos making people come out of them like with a net positive reaction?
Yeah, that's sort of like the same question that I ask myself every, you know, every video. After I've made every video, because there's a real, I don't know, like for me, it's always been a challenge, because YouTube is a very aesthetic platform. And then right now the culture at large is a very aesthetic sort of culture. It's a very image-driven culture, surface-driven culture. And this is why I recently developed a very, you know, such a fascination with fashion, because fashion is all about a surface, all about surfaces. It's all just a surface game. And that sort of brought me back to YouTube. And I've just kind of realized that people watch you not because, well, sometimes they watch you for your information. Sometimes they watch you for your, should I say, your net positive impact that you want to have on their lives. But most, you know, more often than not, people are here for your personality, for, should I say, your looks. I mean, you're a pretty good looking man yourself. And then people come over to you because you have all of these, this mythology that you've constructed around yourself, and this sort of, should I say, Andy Warhol-esque effect of you, you're turning yourself, you're not just a businessman, you're a businessman, you know?
Yeah.
Turning yourself into a business, and that's exactly. Sort of the mythology that you have to like maintain for people to keep coming back to you. So the product people are buying right now when they hop onto one of your videos, that's the mystique that you're sort of embodying. That's the, well, image that you're selling. But, you know, sometimes people can go really far with this image and turn their channel into a completely aesthetic experience. But sometimes that creates a gap between the audience and the creator. And the creator sort of feels like, okay, now I am the leader of this aesthetic or whatever. You know, recently with Dark Academia, that's something that I'm trying to step away from entirely, because I just feel like it's problematic, it's unhealthy. And down the track, you know, because, you know, there's been this sort of like aesthetic change with my channel. Before, I used to dress in a certain way, but now I sort of made a very deliberate effort to cleanse that away from my channel. So right now it's very much about providing real valuable information to sort of detach myself from that mythology that I've constructed around myself. And because this mythology creates an ideal and people idealize you and people mm-hmm. sort of put you on a pedestal and that's mm-hmm. who I want to become. And people feel bad about themselves. And there's this whole game of comparison. And then there's, you know, it's subconsciously, it's a force of conformity, really. Whereas what I want to do with people is that I want to provide people with the keys to person development, you know, especially artistic development. That seems to be my domain. You know, yours is, your content's more about how to improve yourself as a person, but the code that I want to crack is how do we educate ourselves as artists and as people who are, you know, who are creative, how do we nurture this creative force this little force that wasn't exactly encouraged in school. So I want to give people another kind of education that they kind of missed out in school and to encourage people to really be the kind of creatives they are. So every time I finish a video, that's what I ask myself. Have you provided some valuable information that's not a product of your mystique or your aura or this image, this mythology that you constructed? And I remember Andy Warhol mm-hmm. said a quote recently in his book, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol. He basically said, if you're a photographer, you should count up exactly how many pictures you have. If you're an actress, you should count up all the movies you've been in. And if you're a writer, you should just count up all the words you have and then decide how much you're worth from there. And never rely on your aura or your mystique to sell stuff, because that's just not a good measurement of being, you know, being a good creator. So that's, ever since reading that paragraph, I'm like, that's the quota that you have to go by. How many videos have you made that's information packed, that's encouraging enough? And then how many positive comments have you received telling you, hey, you've changed my perspective on this? So that's the metric mm-hmm. that I'm going by now.
Mm-hmm. And that is, it's much more fulfilling and sustainable that way. I feel like, you know, I, instead of, I've made the shift over the years as well, where, you know, and it's still hard to get into this frame of mind where I'm thinking more about impact and less about views. And you would think with common sense, it would say, oh, the more views you have, the bigger impact you're making. But definitely not the case with YouTube videos, where a lot of YouTube videos that get pushed out heavily by the algorithm aren't really that impactful.
They're like, pretty stupid.
Kinda, yeah, like they're just kind of nonsense. So yeah, I think that's important for all creators to keep in mind and have that mindset shift, along with still having the mindset shift of, like, you know, improving your business is important and getting to a higher level is important, just not putting all your focus on that.
Just want to make a quick word from a company that is helping to support this podcast, which is Vivo Life. If you don't know what Vivo Life is, it is an all vegan company that is producing the highest quality supplements on the market. I personally was following and buying Vivo Life products before they even reached out to me to become an ambassador, and they're just an amazing team. What they're doing with their products is really special. As a vegan who's trying to build muscle, I take their protein powder every single day, and I also take their Thrive multinutrient, which comes with a bunch of multivitamins, a fruit and vegetable blend, and probiotics as well to support your gut health. As far as their protein powder goes, it is the best on the market. It is made with fermented pea and hemp protein, and it has digestive enzymes, so you won't get that protein bloat. It also blends amazing, and it contains turmeric extract, which helps with recovery, and it also has 42% of your recommended daily intake of iron. It really is the best protein powder out there. All of their supplements also come in compostable packaging, and they plant a tree with every order. So it really is just an amazing vegan company. If you are interested, you can go to vivolife.com. That is vivolife.com. And at checkout, you can use the code COLE10, COLE10, for 10% off your order. That is vivolife.com, and use the code COLE10 at checkout. All right, let's get back to the episode.
But I want to rewind the clock a little bit here to what we were talking about earlier, where you were saying, you know, you're a 40-year-old in a 20-something-year-old's body. So it seems like you've always had an inclination to books, reading, storytelling, writing, or have you not? Where did that come from? When did you first get into writing?
It started with, like any other kids out there, you know, as a kid, I don't want to say that I've always felt different, but I was never into like kicking soccer balls with my friends on the pastures, or I was never quite into like, you know, in high school boys were, you know, going after girls or whatever, doing that entire thing. I was always in the library just reading and then trying to figure out what life is, you know. So stuff that used to interest other people, they didn't really interest me that much. And that's not to say that I'm special, but I just think there's kind of like this sentiment that really, you know, made me kind of, you know, set me up to be the kind of person who's really into, you know, the finer and subtler art forms in life. So I distinctly remember that, like, the first time when I really started reading, like, very seriously, that was like, so I basically started with a bunch of self-help books on my dad's shelves, and I was, like, reading these business books. I didn't understand them, but I think those few years of reading those self-help books really set up a really strong foundation for me to, like, do personal development and to really understand what life is about. And then at some point after reading, like, you know, in the span of 4 years, read over 200 self-help books. That's when I got into this engineering school. So this lead engineering school. And it was just kind of like this process of, you know, if you graduate from this school, you're going to get yourself a bachelor in science and you're basically going to be an engineer. And that was sort of the path that I was ready to go down. I was pretty proficient in mathematics and was pretty happy. Well, not exactly happy. It seemed like a logical next step. But I just remembered that, you know, at the time I was like, just in those classes, I was just so miserable. And the way those classes were taught weren't exactly up to, you know, up to my par or up to my standards, because I feel like to learn is to, you know, probe really deeply into the principles of how the universe works. That's, you know, that's one of the first reasons why. And that's one of my prime reasons for studying science, is to understand how the universe works. But the coursework turned this amazing process of exploration, it turned it into this dry, repetitive drilling process. And I'm like, I can't do this forever. You know, I can't even do this for the rest of the year. So I sort of had this crisis. And after that crisis, I've decided, you know, to understand life, I can't keep doing science. To understand life, I can't keep, you know, constricting myself to spreadsheets. I have to advance beyond it to really understand what the humanities are about. So that sort of became this intellectual renaissance of like this enlightenment period of me digging into stuff like philosophy, digging into stuff like literature, and digging into stuff like, you know, so a lot of books. And now it's kind of like a step beyond the self-help that I was looking for. So self-help is very contemporary. It's very helpful. It's very, you know, practical. But I was sort of like looking for that next dimension of improvement and that next dimension of life lessons, so to speak. You know, what are some of the deepest wisdom from ancient Greek, well, in ancient Greek philosophy, or what are some of the secrets of languages by, you know, from a treatise by Wittgenstein, or what are some of the great lessons from, you know, the good old classics, the canonical classics. So right now I'm reading the Three Musketeers in French, actually. So I ask myself that every single day, you know, what are some of the greatest lessons that I don't currently know that's going to set me up to live like the kind of person that I want to live as, you know, how do I be the kind of person who's able to relate to not just, you know, common people right now, but also to relate to people of the past. And that sort of motivated me to, you know, dive deeper and deeper and deeper into literature, into philosophy. And that gradually morphed into writing, because writing is the most potent form of communication. And yeah, that's how I started. It started with this insatiable desire and hunger to figure out what life is, and realizing that self-help wasn't going to be enough, realizing that scientific pursuits weren't going to be enough. So this, I think it's a craving for an extra dimension.
It's interesting you bring that up, because I recently had somebody comment on one of my videos, and the video is titled "Stop Reading Self-Help Books," but that's, yep. I mean, that's clickbait. It's what it really means is stop reading self-help books and not applying the information in them, which a lot of people do. They just consume and don't actually apply it. So it's like they're just useless. But that's a topic for another day. What somebody said on that was that self-help is the training wheels that you eventually have to take off. And that stuck with me because I too went through a similar transformation. You know, I don't really watch self-help content anymore. I don't read self-help books anymore. The last time I sat down and read a self-help book from front to back was, who knows, over a year ago, I think, if we don't count philosophy as self-help, which I don't, even though, I mean, you know, some forms of existentialism or stoicism could be considered that. But yeah, I do like that as well. I do kind of agree with it, where it's like, you know, there's only so much you can learn from self-help, just the typical like standard self-help advice. At that point, what you must do is, I suppose, two things. The first thing you mentioned, which is, you know, expanding into other areas of writing and reading and comprehending, and also experiencing life. I think life is the best teacher. I think no matter how many books you read on how to make money or how to become a better video editor, what's going to help you make more money is just trying to make more money, more like actually trying to, or editing more. You know, I learned all of my experience with editing. Like, yes, I learned a lot of cool ways to edit from YouTube. And that's where I got started. But like the reason I'm so efficient now and can just like, I feel like there's a certain flow that you can feel with a video that you naturally develop that you can't learn in a book. You can only learn it through editing itself. And so, yeah, self-help is the training wheels. I think
to some level, it's just fear that's holding people back because there's this paralysis by analysis, you know. You know, but before you start a thing, you read every single little thing about the subject and you end up, you really end up shooting yourself in the foot, because sometimes the best way to learn a thing is to experience it yourself and then be okay with the consequences. And, you know, this is why a lot of people, dating, for example, is such a good example. You can read all the dating books in the world. You can read all the articles about how to maintain a good relationship, and you can basically become the master. You can become a therapist, you know, for other couples. But yet, if you don't, should I say, take that leap of like actually falling in love, actually making a mess, actually, you know, getting heartbroken, getting hurt, and somehow recovering from all of that, like you never learn. And whatever you learn is just out of fear, because you want certainty without realizing that a lot of life is just, you know, blatantly uncertain. You never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, you never really know who you're going to fall in love with. And you never really know which path of life you're going to go down.
Absolutely, man. I've said that. I don't know. You damn near quoted one of my videos about like relationships in general. I don't know if you saw it, but yeah, it's just like, you know, you can learn so much about how to talk to women or how to understand women on the internet and YouTube and all these guys. And, you know, there's the red pill culture. I don't know if you're familiar with, but that's what my next video is actually about and what I like and don't like about it. But in that video at the end, also, along with the video I already have out, it's like I encourage people to get in relationships where you don't know what's going to happen and it's uncertain and it's scary, but that's where you're going to learn the most about relationships, about how to create a better relationship in the future. And like the more you fail in relationships or get your heart broken and shit, you come out of it having gained so much knowledge, as long as you reflect on it properly. And I hope most people would, but yeah, I do feel like if I had just like consumed content on relationships and didn't actually get into relationships when I was, you know, I had one relationship when I was from like 15 to 19 or 15 to 18, then one relationship from 20 to 23. And it's just like, I wouldn't know anything about dating, no matter how much content I consume, because everybody's giving you their advice, what they've experienced, which is a very, it has a lot of blind spots that you're not going to be able to see past if you don't just do the thing yourself. So yeah, that's why that's people were like, so you're telling people you should get heartbroken? I'm like, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's been one of the best teachers in my life for sure.
Yeah. Because I firmly believe that, if you really want to test out your degree of self-mastery, if you really want to test out how person developed you are, or like how, you know, how well put together you are, everything is just a whole bunch of malarkey. You know, everything's just kind of like self-input, because when you're single, no one gives a crap how you act. When you're single, you can just do whatever you want and then get away with it. Basically, you can just, you're by yourself. You can eat pizza. You can like go to sleep at 3 a.m. while watching reruns of The Simpsons, you know, do all that kind of stuff. And no one's going to yell at you, you know, unless you're such a failure that your mom decided to come to your door and yell at you. But like, no one's going to care. And you can bask in your own sort of quote self-mastery without realizing that you still have a lot of patches of yourself to work through. So that's what I currently or used to experience, recently experienced with. Well, I just came out of a, I wouldn't call it a long-term relationship. It was pretty, you know, reasonably termed. It's not too long, not too short, but it basically made me realize that I have patches of myself that are just so full of neurotic tendencies and full of, should I say, things that need to be ironed out, so to speak. And a good relationship or a relationship that fell apart for the right reasons should teach you exactly that. It's like a mirror that's like held up against your face. It's just like, look, you're not perfect. You're far from perfect. You know, all these idiosyncrasies that you think are good to keep, you know, that's going to prevent you from having a better relationship in the future. So meanwhile, when you're heartbroken, that's a really great period for you to self-reflect. And that's a really great period for you to be like, okay, so I've discovered that I'm this incredibly jealous person. So what's up with that? And get curious about it and just sort of go inward and somehow through observation, observe all of the ways that you're jealous about a situation. Over time through observation, it just irons itself out. And then you learn through experience. You're sort of like, your intuition sort of does these, you know, checks and bounds. And yeah, I think heartbreaks are just absolutely, absolutely critical to your person development. It destroys the illusion of self-mastery. And if you happen to find yourself sometime down a track in the future in a relationship that you feel like, oh my God, I'm a very confident person. I'm a very secure person now. That's true self-mastery, not the sort of echo chamber effect of like, you think you're great and no one's telling you otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't have said it better. Yeah, no. Now I want to get into something that is admittedly very much for myself, but I think will benefit a lot of the listeners, all the listeners actually. And that's just, I just want to talk to you about storytelling.
Yeah, sure.
About writing, the importance of storytelling. And yeah, let's start with that. Like, why do you think telling stories is so important? And I personally think, you know, especially in this past year, because I've done so much work within self-improvement, that reading fiction has been far more impactful on my life than reading self-help books. So why do you think that's so important?
Well, stories hold civilizations together. That's basically a one sentence answer. You know, I remembered, I think it was from a movie, Genius, Colin Firth and Jude Law. So it's about this writer named Thomas Wolfe, and he was an amazing American writer. You know, I think it's it's in the same era as, like, you know, I think it's the late modernism where things are sort of calming down. Things are not as avant-garde anymore. So Thomas Wolfe basically has this amazing, incredible ability to write in this style that documented basically the state of America through the Great Depression and through when the nation was really falling apart. So then in this movie, Colin Firth was like, was with Jude Law, well, Thomas Wolfe's character on a rooftop. And they were basically talking about storytelling and basically talking about the importance of telling stories. And I really do think it's this when, so I think allegedly the first storyteller was someone near, you know, near a campsite, near the fires. And then, you know, they're sitting down near the fire. They could hear, you know, wolves howling in the distance, you know, elephant noises, and then tiger howls. You know, no one knows what's going to happen out there. And no one knows what's beyond this little patch of light, of fire. No one knows the beyond. No one really knows what's going to happen tomorrow. But one of the people near the, you know, near the fireside is going to start talking, and he's going to, or they're going to tell a story, you know. You know, gender pronouns and stuff, they're going to start telling a story. And that story is, in a sense, a conceptualization of what's beyond. And that's the story that's going to make people feel less afraid. That's the story that's going to make people feel like, hey, there's a grasp on reality. And there's a grasp on not necessarily truth. You know, fiction is not truth, but fiction can be just that glue that holds our sanities together. You know, fiction could be just be that little bit of something that gives us a patch of security or a patch of, you know, sort of like that redemptive sort of faith in believing in that we could be better, humanity could be better, and we could become better people. And in a sense, it's all about piecing together scattered information into a cohesive whole. Like, that's what storytelling really is. Because if you go through your day, you probably encounter 20,000 different things every single day. And you go through a heartbreak, or you go through an amazing event in your life, like moving to a new city, like you just did. But all of that stuff, those are just scattered visions and scattered sounds and scattered people you've met, or this or this or this or that. And if there's not a system for you to categorize all of it, if there's not a system for you to, like, tell a story about it, if there's not a skill for you to, like, conceptualize that entire string of scattered experience into a cohesive whole, then you're going to lose a sense of that bigger picture. You're going to lose a sense of that faith in yourself. And then your life will just descend into, should I say, a primordial kind of chaos. And that chaos is, should I say, the worst place to be in, because you don't know where your life is going to go. You don't exactly know if the things that you're doing are right or correct or righteous. So storytelling for me is maintaining that faith in yourself, and part stringing together, should I say, seemingly mundane and scattered events into cohesive whole. It's really, for me, it's really just an exercise of learning, because if you don't have this grand event, if you don't have this narrative for you to learn from, all you're going to have is just a scattered string of things that you can't make sense of. So storytelling, for me at least, is the best way to gain insights into myself, insights into who I want to be in the future. And it's also, you know, something to keep me on track, something to keep that blind faith in humanity going. Because, you know, with the things that are happening in the world right now, it's not necessarily easy to do just that. But storytelling makes it just 10% better.
Yeah, I feel the same sort of connection to storytelling. You know, when I think about my life as a teenager, and even as a child, it's so difficult for me to remember, like, most things that happened from my past, because I felt like I didn't have a way in which I could connect all the pieces together like you were describing. And because of that, my self-awareness suffered quite a bit. Now, was that because of my not too good storytelling skills? Or was it because I was smoking weed pretty much every single day as a teenager? I don't know. But I would say, yeah, storytelling has played a big part into improving my self-awareness. Because now, you know, I've just started like honing it, and I guess I like unintentionally was doing it when, like, one of the big reasons I think my channel really grew and exploded was because I shared my stories about things that I went through and how I handled them in my past. And I didn't really realize it at the time that it was the stories that were attracting people to my channel. Because before I was just saying, you know, like top 10 tips to be more attractive. Like nobody gives a shit about that. My retention reflects that. The views reflect that. It's just as much as people think that they want the facts, what they want something to connect with. They want to feel the emotions behind your brand, and the way you do that is to become a better storyteller. And you explained it very, very well. And I want to go over ways in which people can do that with themselves in their own lives. How do you improve your storytelling, and what are the core elements of a really great story?
Shameless plug here. Recently, I just did a Skillshare course on how to keep a writer's diary. So okay. In that program,
what's the title of it?
It's Fictionalize Your Life, How to Keep a Writer's Diary. So you can search that on Skillshare. And it's basically a little 30-minute program about, because I, inspired by David Sedaris, he's one of my greatest, one of my greatest greatest idols ever, should I say. Like one of the people who really inspired me to master storytelling, and not just storytelling in the sense of like grandiose storytelling, but his writing is so down to earth, and it is so just about mundane reality. And, you know, some of the essays were literally about him going to France and struggling to learn French. And it's just so well done that Dave Sedaris basically shows people that you can tease a story out of any ordinary thing in reality. You can basically make a story out of anything. And David Sedaris is more of a humorist, but the same case could be applied to other forms of storytelling. If you want to tell a really heartfelt story, you can find that story anywhere. And David Sedaris basically inspired me because he kept a diary, his digital diary, from when he was 20 all the way till when he was like, you know, now he's, I think he's in his 70s now. No, close to his 70s. But he kept a diary entry every single day. And recently he published all of his diary entries from, I think, 2013 to 2020 or something like that. It's called, you know, Carnival of Snackery. But his method of keeping a diary had this quality of storytelling to it that's just so immediately humorous and so immediately quick-witted and funny and so ridiculous, so absurd, that basically inspired me to keep my own version of the David Sedaris diary. So that's what I talked about primarily in the course, which is how to keep a daily account of this sort of observational humor or observational way of observing reality whilst, you know, building up that discipline of conceptualizing your day, the day that you've just lived through, as a story. So what's one story out of today that you've teased out? Okay, what happened today that you could turn into a story? For example, I think this is a while ago, almost like big half a year ago. So a pigeon flew into my friend Jay's face, and he was scared that the pigeon was going to give him some kind of disease. And I saw that, I was like, hey, that's going to be today's story. Or if I see something on a bus, or if I bump into someone on a train, I'm like, that's going to be today's story. That's going to be today's story. So over time, as you write one short, very short story, you know, 200 words, diary entry every single day, that's going to train your observation to start looking at the world in terms of, you know, a collection of different stories, a collection of things that you do. It's also a great tool for self-reflection and self-awareness, because you can then spot the kind of person you are a few years ago. Sometimes I read my diary entry back in 2019. I'm like, oh my God. You're a completely a different person. I can't even relate to you anymore. So I'm still, so I took a break from this diary entry keeping thing, because over time it turned into something that I'm neurotically keeping instead of just keeping for fun. I'm just keeping it because I have to do this. So I think I need a gap from it to, you know, gain some perspective before I jump back in again. So that's what I'm currently doing right now. But I think after this little break, I'm going to jump back on a wagon write a story about my life every single day, because that is one of the greatest practices that I've kept for 2 years. So now I have a folder on my computer. It has over 300 diary entries, and each entry is basically a short story. So that's basically a jam-packed rocket fire way, or should I say a hardcore way, for you to train your storytelling skills.
Mm-hmm. I think you just gave me the key to get back into journaling, because I have not journaled. I don't even remember. I mean, I've been doing it very sporadically. When I just feel like it, I'm like, I haven't journaled in so long. I used to do this like every single day, like twice a day. But I guess, I don't know. It felt like it got to a point where it was kind of useless for the way I was journaling.
Yeah.
But
because if you journal, typically when people journal, they don't have an objective, and they write about their feelings until their lamp is dry, you know, and they found themselves writing about the same problem or the same thing, you know, day after day after day. Of course you're going to get bored. So whereas if you keep this storytelling diary, every day something new happens and it pushes you out of your head to observe reality. And that's just, you'll never run out of stuff to write about if you keep a diary that way.
Man, that is, you got me excited now.
I'm glad.
As far as that goes, typing versus paper, I know you personally use paper a lot, journals, and I believe fountain pens as well. What do you think is the advantage to that?
I sort of go back and forth, because I feel like when I write with pen and paper, it's more of an intimate experience. It's so much slower than it is on a computer. And it is so much more real, should I say, when I write it down on paper, because I used to also take calligraphy classes. So I'm very particular about how my letters look and how the cursive looks on a page. So that to me is basically meditation whenever I write things down. But with the computer, for example, because I've realized that it's just not realistic to keep 300 diary entries physically. That's going to, if I want to move anywhere potentially, that's going to be a solid nightmare. So for this aspect of sort of like storytelling, I stick with computer, because it's so much easier to organize. It's so much easier to categorize in different folders. But for, should I say, more private reflections, for my personal sketches, and for things that I rather keep to myself, or drafts for online articles, this is an exception, because for me, when I draft in my scrapbook on my blog, it's basically an exercise of crossing a lot of things out. I like to have fun with it. So that's also on paper, because you can immediately edit whatever you don't like on paper, whereas on a computer, it's tough, because you can't see your mistakes, whereas on paper, it's blatantly clear. So private reflections, personal journals, and my blog posts, they're all on paper, because I just feel like it's a very pleasurable way to get ideas out. But for the storytelling journal, it is so much better. It's so much better on a computer.
Oh, the storytelling journal is better on a computer, you're saying?
Because you can pursue the thread of the narrative a lot quicker. Because I feel like on paper, because I'm writing a lot slower, I couldn't quite click into that narrative writing mode. Because on paper, I feel like I'm way too introspective to get a narrative out of myself. Whereas on a computer, it's just like tap, 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 tap. I can sort of like pursue the thread of storytelling.
Interesting. And I just want to dive a little bit deeper. I don't know how much time you have left before class, but I want to dive a little bit deeper into what I was saying before, the core elements of a great story. Like what do you think makes up a great story? Like the specific things like I can think about are like, you know, exposition, tension, conflict, you know, what makes up a great story, and like describing those words.
Personally, you know, there's of course conflict and personal transformation, and then all the kind of stuff that you tend to see in a really good story and a hero's quest, so to speak. But for me personally, I feel like a story is only good when should I say, there's kind of like that landing point at the end of it, and there's sort of like a moral moral lesson, should I say. So you're really old folk tales. With every folk tale, there's kind of like a moral. So that's why sometimes when I read certain things, if I don't happen to land upon something that's like, that's that, you know, at the end of a paragraph or at the end of the story, if there's not that oomph to the story, of course, there could be a lot of tension. Of course, there could be a lot of, you know, we've read all the 50 Shades of Grey's ever, you know, it's just like, there's a lot of tension in those books. And there's, of course, a great story arc. But for me personally, I think it's partly due to my classical upbringing. If there's not that like oomph at the end of the piece of fiction or at the end of a short story, if there's not a landing point, if there's not some philosophical sort of message of the text, I just typically find myself like wondering, why did I even read this stuff? Like it felt like I just wasted my time. It felt like, you know, I can't do anything. I didn't take anything away from the story. That's why sometimes I feel like there are two types of readers. You know, they're very utilitarian readers. They want to learn something, which is me. And they're sort of like central readers. They enjoy a good story just because they don't think too much about it. They don't want to take anything away from it. They just purely enjoy the process of reading that piece of fiction. Whereas for me, I have to sort of dive into the fiction, not with the expectation, but with this craving for something that lands at the end of the story. So something that could hit me in a way that makes me look at reality in a brand new way for in whatever shape or form possible. So I want a piece of fiction to completely distort my sense of reality or to completely sort of transform how I look at the world. And that's why philosophy appeals to me a lot more than just mere fiction, because philosophy is exactly about swapping out the filter that you look at the world with. It gets to a point where you can't even look at your life in the same way anymore after you've read a really good philosophy text. So yeah, so that's what I mainly look for in a good story, something that could inspire me, something that could basically give me a sense of understanding of reality. So fiction, I mean, fiction and philosophy and science for me, I think my life in a nutshell is just a process of understanding. Like I want to understand the world, and that's how I approach stories with. What's that understanding that you're going to give me? Like some of your videos, for example, great storytelling. And there's always something that's at the center of the video. And unlike a vlog or something, you know, we have a lot of YouTube videos that just don't have that sort of moral grounding, or they that's why when you watch them, you feel flimsy at the end. You feel like you've wasted your time. Whereas if I watch one of your videos, for example, it always feels like there's that, like that oomph at the end of each video that I feel like, yep, this is what I'm looking for. That was a great story. And I also took something away from it. And I think that for me is very important when it comes down to a good story.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm glad you recognize that, because I do try to, of course, have the audience come out of something or have something come out of each video. But like specifically at the end, you know, I really try to pound it into their brains. I guess I have like a method to my videos now that I've been following for a while. But yeah, I like that. Good tips. And last thing is, do you have maybe two or three books you can recommend about how to become a better writer or storyteller? And also just your favorite two or three books of all time.
Two or three. Wow. That's tough.
Is it? Well, then only do one.
One on storytelling. So I think I'll recommend two storytelling books and one book that I just particularly enjoyed. So the first one is Consider This by Chuck Palahniuk. So Palahniuk wrote Fight Club, you know, very, very good storyteller. And he's more of like this pulp fiction sort of genre. So if you want to write fiction, or if you want to tell stories that are more like grungy in nature, think of Fight Club, think of all the works of Chuck Palahniuk's works. Absolutely amazing fiction writer. Consider his book, Consider This. So it's basically a book full of tips, writing tips and character construction tips that you can use to tell your story or to tell stories that you want to tell. The other one is basically Stephen King's On Writing. You know, this is sort of like a treasure trove of writing advice. And Stephen King did it in a way where it's like, it turns into a part biography. and part writing advice. And he did it so beautifully that even the writing tips, they weren't boring or dry to read. And some paragraphs are so ridiculously funny that you'll find yourself laughing to yourself throughout the middle of the night. And you're like, no, I'm just reading Stephen King's own writing. So those are the two writing books that I particularly enjoyed. I'm just looking at my bookshelf now. And a book that I really personally enjoyed, also along the lines of storytelling, was Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris. And Sedaris is perhaps one of my favorite writers of all time. So David Sedaris wrote this book about him going to Paris and embarrassing the hell out of himself. And then his writing style is basically short little essays. So if you really want to learn how Sedaris turned his own little life into stories, how he turned his own, misfortunes into comedy, well, consider Me Talk Pretty One Day by David Sedaris. And yeah, three books.
Sweet. Okay, I'll definitely have to check those out as well. And would you like to plug your book as well and the places in which people can find you online?
Yeah, sure. So the books were just sort of up there on the internet, but one of the pieces of fiction that I was particularly proud of was There's a Tale to the City. So it's co-authored with two of my best friends. One of them was Jay and Jaden. So we basically went around the streets of Melbourne and we collected stories and tales from homeless people of the streets, and we described the streets, and we basically decoded Melbourne, which is my home city, as this fantastic place of tales. And we basically wanted to use this book as an invitation for other people to find similar tales in their home cities. So that's why we titled it There's a Tale to the City. But then again, YouTube is my main thing. YouTube, I share video essays on creativity, and I make video essays on my personal journey of pursuing this understanding of creativity. And of course, you can find me on Instagram, and I post regular blogs on my website, blog posts on my website, rcwalden.com. And that's all I have to plug.
Excellent. All right, RC, such a pleasure.
Thanks awesome for having me.
Finally talking to you. And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time
to do this.
Hope you have a good rest of your day at school.
Thank you. Yeah, that is it for us. Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Cole.